Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jared. We're good to go.
Yes. Excellent.
Okay. So, hey, let's start with your year of graduation, including if that was spring, summer, fall, and your major.
Sure. I graduated in fall 2009 with a degree in jazz composition.
Okay. Very cool. You're not my first jazz composition major, but you're close.
Yeah, there aren't very many of us, so that's not surprising.
Nice. Okay, I'm sorry, you said spring of 09?
Fall 09.
Fall 09, got it.
Yeah.
And what was your principal instrument?
Voice, actually. I entered Berkeley, originally got accepted as a trombone player, and I got my wisdom teeth out and couldn't get my chops back up quickly enough, so I switched to vocal right before I started, so...
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. So, hey, we will get to your history later.
Sounds good.
Now, tell us about your current job. What do you do? Where do you do it?
Sure. I am a staff accountant at a startup in San Francisco called La Tote. It's a women's fashion company that does women's rentals. So you pay a monthly membership fee and you get a box in the mail with three items of clothing and two accessories, and you get to use them as much as you want and then send them back. And we do all the cleaning, all the laundry, all the hanging, all the storage, and then send you another box.
So it's kind of like Netflix for clothing.
Exactly. It's like the old DVD version of Netflix, but for women's clothing. And we also include things like earrings and watches and belts and things like that in the boxes for accessories.
And could I ask, at least for DVD Netflix, of course, people are choosing the movies online. Like, are women choosing what they get, or do they basically get the surprise box for the month?
Sort of the middle ground between the two. One of the great things about what the company does is that we use a lot of proprietary data from manufacturers as well as data from each individual woman customer who gives us their measurements to match them to clothing that we think would fit them well. Mm-hmm. And then we use their individual style preferences to dial in even further to get them what they would like to wear. And the idea is that when you first join, a customer will have a whole survey of, you know, do you like this style of clothing or that style, or which things would you never wear? And as the customer gets more boxes and rates those boxes that come in, they're called totes, which is why the company's called La Tote. As she rates more and more items, the algorithm starts to get smarter and smarter about what that woman would want. And so over time, eventually you end up getting boxes of just things you like that should fit well right off the bat. It usually takes a box or two to really fine tune it, but we've done a pretty good job of making it more like one box than two. So it's definitely been an interesting ride doing that, because the application of data to women's clothing has not really been a thing in the past.
That's interesting. Hey, I'm just curious, neither here nor there, but do people have the ability to purchase the clothing if they really like it?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we send out a box, let's say you get a shirt you love, you can just keep the shirt and send everything else back. And then when we open the package, all of our clothes have a hidden RFID tag inside of them. So we just scan whatever you bring back. And if anything's missing, we charge you for the item that you kept. And all the items are variable priced based on a whole host of factors I won't get into. But the idea is that it's dynamic pricing. So you'll get a discount off of the retail price, and usually it's closer to wholesale than retail, or retail, rather.
Wow. So in other words, you can purchase these for pretty reasonable if you like them.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And they've all been cared for per manufacturer specifications, and, you know, we have a commercial laundry and dry cleaning facility at our distribution centers. So usually everything's in pretty good condition as well, so it makes it a lot easier to know what you're getting. And since you actually physically have the clothing before you make the commitment to purchase, it makes it – it's actually kind of a cool way to try before you buy. You can put something on and say, do I like this or not? And there's no commitment, and there's no – you can still wear it out for a night and then send it back, and that's totally fine.
Sure.
That's a cool program.
Wow. Yeah, that is a cool service. About how big is the company?
Right now, we have about 450 employees. We are on the upward swing still. We're actually opening a second distribution center. We're in the process of building it out in Columbus, Ohio. And our current distribution center actually moved from our current office out into Stockton, California. So we have, I think since I started, we quadrupled in size by headcount. So it's definitely fast growing startup stuff going on out here.
Yeah, got it. And you mentioned about how many customers do you know?
That's a good question. I think we're around 60,000 subscribers.
Okay.
Which, again, that's quadrupled or quintupled approximately since I started.
Your startup, but that's still a pretty large-sounding number of customers.
Definitely. I mean, startup is sort of a relative term. I mean, the company's been around since 2012. But we're still definitely, we were moving sort of in like a trickle of growth for a long time. And then in 2016 and 2017, we really slammed down on the gas pedal and really, really expanded aggressively.
Gotcha. So you said you're a staff accountant.
I am.
So of these 400 plus employees, how many of them are staff accountants?
Just one.
Just you.
Just me. If it involves money, it crosses my desk. And the funny thing is that I was actually the first accountant they hired. They hired a chief financial officer about 3 weeks before me. I got brought in to do the books, and they had never had a bookkeeper. They never had an accountant before. And so there was a lot of me doing cleanup for quite a while when I first started, and building out a lot of accounting processes. So, it's actually been very interesting work. The rental model is very different than a traditional business, and so we have to account for things differently. So a lot of these things that cross my desk have been, you know, nobody's ever done this before. How should we do this? Kinds of questions. So it's been an interesting ride.
Challenging.
Definitely.
Okay, cool. So it sounds like you report to the chief financial officer.
I do, and actually there's also now a finance manager who is in our department. We're up to four people in the finance team now. And the finance manager does a lot of the day-to-day review of my work, but I report into the chief financial officer.
Got it. Is there anyone whom you supervise, or?
Not at this point. I don't have any reports. I do kind of feel like I have to supervise how people are spending money and things like that, but it's not a direct supervisor relationship.
Sure. You don't do their evaluation.
Gotcha.
So you keep all the books straight. I assume there's some outside audit that happens once a year, and you probably work with them too.
Yep, definitely. And actually, this year, because of the growth and everything else, we've had to enter into new agreements with banks, and, you know, we've taken on debt and gotten money from investors. And so the outside audit has kind of turned into several smaller outside audits, because each firm wants, you know, a specific thing checked out, or, you know, we need an inventory count, or whatever it is. So this year we actually had four audits, or last year, rather, 2017, we had four audits. And all those were with outside auditors, and most of them were trying to do the same things, and they didn't want to communicate with one another. And so lots of audit coordination in my past.
Gotcha. Now, I always get the impression that accountants have the busier seasons and the less busy seasons, though you're at a startup. About how many hours a week do you work?
More than I think usually. I'm supposed to be working 40 hours a week. I think the reality is that it's more like 45 to 50 on average. Mm-hmm. But that fluctuates a lot. There will be weeks where I do a straight 40 hours and I don't have to do anything outside of my normal day. And then there are also times when maybe I'm taking my computer home and working on the couch, or I'm working on Saturday or whatever, depending on the needs of the business and kind of where we are in the monthly and quarterly and annual accounting cycle. So it's kind of a cyclical thing. At the beginning of the month, I tend to be busier because I'm closing the previous month. And then at the end of the month, I'm preparing to close the month again. And then it kind of all moves in waves.
Sure. Next question I have for you, let's not go too deep into your background for this, but I'm curious. And let me just say, I'm asking you in the context of being a Berklee professor without a musical background.
Okay, lay it on me.
Yeah, just like, did you have any like background in the fashion industry or?
Oh, zero. I actually, I'm pretty sure I'm the least fashionable person in the company. And we have an entire floor of just engineers, and I'm pretty sure I'm the least fashionable person. I wear the same 5 polo shirts and 3 or 4 pairs of jeans and the same pair of Nikes to work every single day. And I've been pointed out for that, and it's never really been an issue or anything, but I definitely – I don't even necessarily know that I had an interest in fashion per se before I joined, but one of the main reasons I joined is just the problem solving aspect of it.
Right, it's a job, and you're handling the numbers and the.
Definitely, but it's even beyond that. I mean, the company is trying to solve for known problems, especially in women's fashion, like things like sizes not being consistent from brand to brand. You know, a women's 6 in one brand may fit like a 4 in another, or like an 8 in yet another. And so we're trying to kind of cut through some of that.
Oh, I see what you mean, because once a woman gives you your measurements, you have the database to know which brands are which actual sizes.
Right. And we have a team that literally measures clothing before we enter anything into the system so that we know how they fit before somebody gets the item of clothing. And so, you know, the company is doing this sort of high-level problem solving for these very granular problems. And the accounting is the same way. There are a lot of things that we encounter that 99% or more of other companies don't encounter because we're doing rentals or because, you know, we're not technically selling clothes. So there's a question of sales tax liability and things like that, where maybe somebody who has just done basic accounting processing might not think of those things. And it's kind of a nice added bonus to be trusted with these kinds of problem solving issues.
Gotcha. Hey, can we like zoom in and can you take us through your typical day to the extent
sure.
you have one?
Part of being in a startup is that there isn't necessarily a typical day, but I definitely, I have sort of typical weekly flows and monthly flows.
Sure.
And usually at the beginning of the month, I'm focused a lot on the month-end close. And so I'm looking at transactions from the previous month. I'm looking at the bank transactions. I'm looking at reconciling our accounts payable, which is, you know, the bills we owe to our vendors. Mm-hmm. We're looking at revenue analysis, like how much money did we take in? How much of that can we actually recognize as revenue? You know, if somebody buys a gift card, how much of the gift card did they use? How much do they have left? We have to value and amortize our inventory because it's not like we buy a shirt for $10 and we sell it for $20. We made $10. It's not that simple. Because we rent the clothing, we have to determine how long a garment would normally last in terms of how many times it's worn or taken by a customer. And then let's say we have a shirt and we buy it for $10 and it can be worn 10 times on average. Every time that item of clothing goes out and comes back, we have to depreciate or rather amortize $1 of the expense.
Sure.
And so there's a lot of that kind of analysis, like how many times did which garments go out and how do we expense it? So there's a lot of just trying to make sense out of what happened for the previous 30 days for the first, I'd say, week and a half of the following month.
Mm-hmm.
Every 2 weeks, I also process the payroll for everybody. So there's also a lot of running through time cards and salary adjustments and bonuses and oops, I forgot to take out money for this person's 401k last paycheck. I have to make a correction or whatever it may be. And then on the back end, adding all that into the accounting system, thankfully now I've kind of been spending less time on this set part of the job, but I have historically done a lot of accounts payable work, matching orders to POs and did we receive all the goods and are the vendors angry with us? Did we not pay that bill on time? Things like that. And trying to make sense out of that. I get a lot of email inquiries about, hey, you know, did you get this invoice? Hey, you know, I have a customer who's saying their credit card they can't get their money back on their credit card because they canceled their account, but we need to refund them. How do we get them their money back? So there's a lot of internal customers as well. I work with almost every department in the company to kind of try to keep the numbers straight and pay out or take in money where it's needed. And let's see, what else do I do? There's a lot of other things that I do. I manage all the fixed asset purchases. So all the computers we buy, all the equipment we buy for the distribution center, which is a surprisingly large amount, forklift rentals and lease schedules and all kinds of good stuff, spreadsheets galore. I live in Excel 99% of the time. And at the end of the day, I mean, it's really about making sure our records are correct and that we can justify why the records say what they say and how they say what they say. So I spend a lot of my time doing work and then going back and justifying my work.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. As you say, keeping meticulous records, because...
Oh, yeah. Meticulous records, but also being able to explain them. Because, I mean, I can keep meticulous records, but if I can't remember why I did something, we're in trouble. So there's a lot of writing things down and keeping track and being able to justify it to anyone who wants to know, you know, why did you amortize this item of clothing twice in a month? Well, it got sent out twice, so we amortized it twice. Things like that.
Gotcha. So, Osseous question. Most people, it's a single question, but I'm going to make it a double question for you.
Oh, sounds good. Bring it on.
Because one of the criteria you had to hit in order to do these interviews is that you like what you do, at least your field and ideally your job.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to hear what it is about your job that you like. And here's where it breaks into the double question. I'd like both to hear kind of what you enjoy about being an accountant. And then I also think of a lot of accountants is just like working for large accounting firms. Mm-hmm. And is there anything that you enjoy about being the staff accountant as opposed to working at a large accounting firm?
Sure. Well, there are a lot of things actually I like about accounting in general and my job specifically.
Please.
The accounting in general is one of the best things about it, and this is sort of practical off the top, but everyone needs an accountant in some form or another. It could be that and this can come in multiple directions, but, you know, maybe you don't know how much money you're losing or how much money you're making, or, you know, without the financial data, you don't know how to make any decisions. And that's true of individuals, you know, doing their taxes. It's true of small businesses trying to find a way to make more money. It's true of large scale businesses trying to find tax advantages. There's always somebody who has to count the money or, you know, how much money there should be or whatever. So the prevalence of accounting is great. The applicability of the skills that I have in account that I've gained through accounting has been unbelievable. My, you know, personal finances have totally shifted since I've gotten more into this because I think about money in a different way. And from on a personal fulfillment level, I mean, there's a lot of problem solving. There is definitely some math, although a lot less math than you'd think. So it's also kind of nice when people think I'm really good at math when really I'm just really good at manipulating Excel into making me look like I'm good at math. And maybe the most important thing is that, especially, you know, given my education at Berkeley, you know, I majored in jazz composition and I had to take a lot of arranging classes and a lot of theory classes. And accounting is sort of like financial theory in a sense, because you're taking real money, you know how much money you took in or how much money you spent, and you're kind of putting it into imaginary categories to some extent. You know, it's okay, we spent $10,000 and 1,000 of it was for postage. And so you put that into the postage account, even though it's not a real account. It's just where you're putting the information so that you can track, yeah, we spent $1,000 on postage. And so a lot of it is just making sure the money's in the right place, in the same way that it's like, okay, I'm going to write a C major 7 chord. I need to make sure I have the right notes in the right place to make it sound like a C major 7 chord, or else it's going to be some other chord or it's going to sound bad. And so the same thing kind of works with accounting. You need to make sure everything's in the right place on the P&L and on the balance sheet to make sure that the numbers look right at the bottom line, you know? And for me, there's a certain kind of satisfaction of getting that kind of numerical harmony out of something, where like I can tie this back to reality and there's, here we go, it makes sense. And there's, I get a really big piece of satisfaction out of doing that. Cause at the end of the day, I can kind of say, okay, look, I actually was able to look at what we did and make some sense out of it. That, I think that's maybe my biggest personal satisfaction out of doing accounting,
sure.
Making it, you know, cross your T's and dotting your I's and not getting it the wrong way around. And then I forgot, I'm sorry, I forgot what you were saying.
The other thing was just like, is there anything, and there may not be, but is there anything that you enjoy about being like a staff accountant that works for one company as opposed to working for an accounting firm?
Sure. Okay. So,
or even perhaps being an independent accountant.
There are definitely advantages, I think, to being a staff accountant. Although I think there's a lot of people that go, accounting is one of those fields where you can kind of, depending on which way you want to go, you can either start in public accounting and move into private accounting and be a staff accountant or whatever, or you can go the other direction. You can start as a low level, let's say accounts payable person or something, and work your way up and then move into public accounting. It's a little harder to move that way, but there is some movement back and forth. I find that I like working for companies that aren't accounting firms because I'm not surrounded by accountants all the time, for one thing. There's nothing wrong with accountants as a group, but in general, like, we sort of have a certain mindset of, you know, how are we looking at things? How are we looking at the way the business operates? And being surrounded by people with different perspectives and different needs and different desires can really help you understand what you're doing with the numbers. You know, what, you know, maybe I'm building a budget out and I need to know, okay, well, I need to budget this much money for these things, and maybe that's all the information I have and I throw a budget together, but maybe there's more information that I don't have. Like, marketing wants to start TV ads, let's say, or merchandising wants to start introducing hats or whatever it is. It's helpful to not be surrounded by people who are mired in the numbers the way that you are. And it really does make a big difference to be in a place with multiple types of people, I guess is the way to put it. Because I have temped at accounting firms in the past, and I have frequently just eaten by myself on at weird schedules because I don't want to just eat lunch with the people who sit next to me. And part of it is just that I think I like all kinds of people, and there's a certain type of person who winds up as like a staff level role in an accounting firm sometimes, not all the time. But I find that being around creative people and people who maybe program and maybe people who think about advertising more than they think about other things or whatever, it's just more of a diverse set of people to hang out with, which I appreciate. And I think also there's the fact that you get to know the business really intimately, and you can really help a business out if you understand the whole model as opposed to just understanding the numbers that you get handed like you would at a public accounting firm.
Sure. A great answer. So, hey, let's take it back now to 2009.
Sure.
Earlier, if you wish. I mean, guessing you weren't thinking staff accountants?
No. I was not.
See, I was going to say, put us in your headspace of where you were at then, and then let's take it forward one step at a time, kind of both what you were doing and where you were at from there to where you are now.
Sure. I actually may have to go back further to kind of inform what happened in 2009.
But, absolutely.
So I'm going to go all the way back to 2007, because that's when I started at Berkeley. I transferred in as a community college transfer student.
From where?
From College of Marin in Kentfield, California, Marin County.
Cool.
Just north of the Golden Gate. Mm-hmm. And I had transferred over to Berkeley. I didn't think I was going to get in, but I did get in and went to my first semester. Great, fine. And then discovered I didn't have the money to pay for fall tuition.
Oh, no.
So, and this is a common refrain, I'm sure, but I decided, okay, well, I already signed the lease on my apartment. I need to kind of figure out what I'm going to do. And so I took a semester off with the plan of getting a job, saving money, and going back. And I started calling temp agencies, and part of the reason I did that is because I needed money now, and temp agencies tend to be able to get you money in the very near term, as opposed to having to apply 15 different places and go interview, you can kind of get placed somewhere right away at a temp agency. So I made an appointment with this company, Coworks, and they were all the way out in Waltham. And no matter what they tell you, Waltham is really not accessible by public transit from Boston. But I did it anyway. It only took me 2.5 hours. But I got out, and they said, oh, we have a job. You can start on Monday if you want. You know, it's a mailroom job at a law firm. And they gave me, you know, the battery of tests. I don't know if anybody listening to this actually knows about this, but they usually make you take a test like, can you use Word? Can you use Excel? Can you type?
Yeah, I temped a bit back in the day, so yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, you get the idea. And I took all those tests, and they said, you know, you don't really need to take them. It's not a big deal. It's a mailroom job, but we have to do it to fill out the candidate profile. I said, okay, sure, whatever. So I show up on my first day to the law firm. And apparently the staffing agency had sent 5 or 6 people to this firm on that day, and they had sent a rep out, and the rep pulled me aside about half an hour in and said, are you Jared Trace? And I said, yes. And they said, so we got your results back, and it looks like you're proficient in these, you know, in Word, and you can type quickly, and your 10-key speed is off the charts. And apparently I had gotten really fast with 10-key because of my inputting stuff into Finale.
10-key meaning like putting in numbers.
Yeah, like the numerical keypad on the right-hand side of the keyboard. Yep. I was really fast and really accurate with entering data because I was able to, you know, you get your Oxygen 8 synthesizer and you're playing a chord and you can plug in rhythms and it all, you know, I got really fast at using that keypad. And so they said, you know, there's an opening in the accounts payable department. I know you don't have any accounting experience. You want to give it a shot, and if it doesn't work, you can always come back to the mailroom. And I said, sure. And so they brought me up there, and they had me doing data entry for the accounts payable team. And I was pretty good at it. I was able to get stuff entered and get things fixed. And, you know, it sort of became this invoice is a bottomless pit. Like, we need to get this entered, have Jared do it. He can key it pretty quickly. And it was a law firm that had to print public notices, and so you'd end up with these, like, 300-page bills of public notices, and you had to enter each one line by line and match them up. And I was fast, and so they kept me on. And when I returned to Berkeley in the spring, after I had saved up my money, they kept me on part-time as an accounts payable clerk. And so I was working at this law firm out in Newton.
Was it still for the temp agency, or had they sort of brought you on as an employee?
They brought me on as an in-house, like a real employee at the law firm. Cool. So I was working there 2 nights and 1 Saturday a week while I was in school. And at the time, it was, you know, this is a good job. You know, it's pretty flexible. It's in an office. I'm not saying would you like fries with that, which I thought was a huge plus. And it was one of those things where I was able to pay rent and pay my way through school because I was doing, you know, office work on the side.
I was going to say, do you mind? I never asked people about the current pay. Do you mind sharing, like, what you were getting per hour as the accounts payables?
Sure. At the time when I was a temp, I was making $13 an hour, which, you know, that was the highest pay I'd ever made in my life before that. But prior, I'd been working at a bowling alley, so it felt great at the time. And when they hired me on permanently, I was making $16 an hour.
Yeah, that was double minimum wage or something.
Yeah, it was more than double minimum wage at the time. I was making really good hourly pay at the time, and, you know, I didn't want to lose that job. And it enabled me to kind of fly through because I could take summer classes, and, you know, I still had a job, and during breaks they'd let me come in and do extra hours, and it worked out really well. And so this continued all the way through my Berkeley career, and then in 2009 – in spring, I was like 6 credits away from graduating, but one of the classes I needed wasn't offered in the summer, so I had to go back in the fall. And the plan had been for me to come in full time for the summer and then go back to part time for my last semester, kind of work around my schedule and then kind of see what happens. The week before the graduation ceremony in the spring, I got laid off. And
I was just thinking the economy is not in a happy place in 2009.
Right. And actually, this firm was in real estate law. So, yeah, they had been OK for a lot for the early downturn. They never cut my hours. I was OK. And then all of a sudden they cut a whole bunch of the fat out, and I was part of the fat. And so it happens, you know, it's the way of the world. But unfortunately, it happened maybe 2 weeks before I was supposed to start working there full time.
Oh.
And so I ended up working. I took the first job I could get. One of those, I have to pay rent in 6 weeks. I got to get money now kind of situations.
Right.
I took a job in retail. I was actually working as a barista at a Seattle's Best coffee location inside the Borders that used to be in Downtown Crossing in Boston.
Okay.
And
I was just applying madly to lots of stuff.
Anything and everything, you know, trying to maximize the hourly pay and not lose too much of my dignity was kind of the plan at the time.
Sure.
And actually, the job was not great or anything, but I made a lot of friends and all that sort of thing, but it was still, a different situation. And so, I worked at Borders through my last semester at Berkeley. I graduated and kept working there. And, I was in retail for a couple of years before I started to think like maybe I need to figure out what I want to do, because now, I'm trying to gig while I'm working and that's hard to do. And especially because I was usually scheduled to close the store. So I was there till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And then I'm trying to kind of play an 11:30 gig in Cambridge or something. It's very tough to do. And so I eventually kind of thought, well, I need to figure something out. I'm really struggling here. And I started applying to accounting jobs again, because I was like, well, I have a couple years of experience already in this. I'm not an accountant, but I can do things. And I contacted a different temp agency, one that did not make me go all the way out to Waltham this time. And they placed me at a tech company in Boston called Compete. I think they're under a different name now, but they were in Copley Mall. And they were a tech company that did digital advertising analysis I'm still not 100% sure what they did, but they did something in marketing. And they brought me in as a temp accounts payable person again to try to help out with the department. And when I came in, almost their whole accounting team left within a month of me coming in as a temp. And so they just kept giving me more and more work to do and saying, hey, do you know how to do this? In total terror of losing the job and going back to being a barista again, I just kept saying yes and Googling how to do the thing they assigned me. I've always been good at figuring out how to do things.
For what it's worth, that's awesome. Would you believe if I told you this is not the first time I've heard a story like that?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it was one of those, if I hadn't been working retail this whole time, I might have said, no, I don't know how to do that. Can you show me how to do that? But no, it was one of those moments of like this, I just have to figure it out. I know enough about accounting that I can probably make some sense out of it. And it worked out.
And yet they know that you're not like a CPA or anything.
I mean,
they
absolutely. And they also knew that I didn't have a degree in accounting. But they also never asked, like, have you ever taken an accounting course? And I hadn't, I had taken economics and macroeconomics my senior year at the local community college to get out of taking economics in high school. And that was about it. And so I just kind of, they said, hey, you're going to take over fixed assets. Do you know what that is? Do you know how that works? And I said, sure. And then went back to my desk and Googled it and read the Wikipedia article on fixed assets treatments in the United States and just went, how do I do this? And it turns out a lot of accounting, and of course, this is probably one of those things that, university accounting departments would think I was a monster for saying, but a lot of accounting is maybe not intuitive, but it's logical. There's rules to it. If you can follow the rules, you can kind of get by even, and maybe different, doing fixed assets in company A versus company Z, but the general principles usually apply. And so that kind of got me, sort of into the job, and they hired me on as a permanent full-time employee as a staff accountant, like a junior staff accountant at the time. And they just kept giving me more work, basically. And I just kept taking it and figuring it out. And asking for help was maybe 10th choice on the list of how I would figure out how to do something. I just kept doing it because now I'm in. I got to stay in. And eventually, I was working in accounting for this company for about a year and a half. And I started to have like an existential crisis moment of, do I really want to be an accountant? And, you know, I had gone to music school and I had been wanting to be a musician since I was 16. And, you know, what am I doing? What, you know, do I really want to be a pencil pusher? You know, I'm having all these thoughts on my desk all the time. And I started thinking, well, how can I even go back to music now? Like, I'm, you know, I've lost all street cred or whatever nonsense I was thinking at the time.
I mean, had, were you still gigging and stuff while you were doing this or?
Less and less. It's a lot harder to do that all Asia show if you've got work the next day. And so, and also I was playing, you know, I'm a vocalist and a trombone player and I majored in jazz composition, but most of the gigs I took were like, you know, I'm playing bass and singing backup vocals as like the alternate bass player in some guy's terrible ska band or whatever, you know, it was nothing related to what I was actually studying. And so it was sort of like I was on the periphery of the scene anyway. And so I just kind of panicked a little bit and started thinking like, well, what can I do? How can I, you know, get back into music and give it a go? And I started applying to grad school for music. And I actually,
and this was like early 2013.
Yeah. 2012, okay. Roughly 2012. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I got into the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in their jazz composition program for their master's program with a stipend and an assistantship and the whole thing. And, at this time I had met my now fiance and we had decided we're moving to Western Massachusetts. We both wanted to get out of Boston. So we moved west. We're living in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is about 2 hours west of Boston.
Mm-hmm. Cute nice little place.
Town. Yeah, it's a really cool town. Not a lot happening if you're not a college kid, but it's a cool town and a lot of good shows there. The Academy of Music has a lot of good stuff. The Calvin has good stuff and, they have great food. It was a pretty good situation. Except that it turned out I didn't really like the academic competition side of being in the academic environment at the graduate level. There were only maybe six or seven of us in my program. And it was intensely competitive. And my assistantship that I'd been assigned, I was a TA for a 200 student lecture class on the history of jazz. Ooh. And they split the class three ways. So I had 67-ish students in my section. And the way this class worked is they reserved half the seats for incoming freshmen. And they also reserved about a third of those seats for the freshmen on football scholarships. And all of those kids ended up in my section.
Oh, no.
And so I ended up spending a lot of the semester grading fairly bizarre papers or, you know, trying to separate people who were cheating during exams or, you know, TA sessions, like outside of class, like additional help kinds of sessions, trying to explain how to count measures of music to non-musicians so that they could understand what we're talking about when we say 12 bar blues. What does that mean? And as musicians, I think a lot of us have a tendency to think, well, 12 bar blues is a blues that lasts for 12 bars. And it's like obvious. But when you don't even know how to count four beats in a measure at all, like you've never tried it. And then you go in and try to teach at the university level about 12 bar blues. It's intensely frustrating. And you have to explain it 15 different ways because 15 different people need different context, you know?
Sure.
And, you know, I was spending all my time on this course and I wasn't writing anything. And I'm in a jazz composition program. You know, I didn't have time. I was in two ensembles. I'm TAing for this course. I have my regular coursework. And after about, well, the first semester I did fine. I got through it and I went back in the spring and I just was getting exhausted mentally and just drained. You know, it was one of those, I stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning finishing this project that's due at 8 a.m. and then I accidentally oversleep. You know, that kind of stuff started happening. And I realized about halfway through spring semester, I don't want to be here anymore. Maybe I need to go be a pencil pusher. And you know, it's sort of a false dichotomy. It's not like I only had those two choices, but at the time it felt like I can keep doing what I'm doing or I can go get a job that's not horrible and go live my life and, you know, figure out something later. You know, in that moment it was, what do I do now? You know, I've already abandoned the good job that I had and came here. And, I ended up sticking out most of the spring semester, and I kind of faded out at the end and took a job doing bookkeeping for a small company in Northampton that does study abroad programs. So it's like it was a company that did, like, let's say you go to a school that doesn't offer a program in the country where you want to go, mm-hmm. they would be able to hook you up with a program in that country. Like, let's say you're going to Berkeley and you don't necessarily want to go to Valencia or wherever, but you want to go to Egypt. This school would be able to partner, in theory, to get you into an Egyptian program to study things. So I was doing their books for a while. So,
and you got that job again, just probably applying for it, or was it another temp agency?
Applying for it. I spent a lot of time during my office hours as a TA looking for jobs on Craigslist, trying to figure out if there was like a way out of this.
That job at that tech firm in Boston, did they ever convert? They did convert, hire you on as like their own staff, or were you through the agency the whole time?
I was through the agency for about 2 months, and then they hired me on full time.
Gotcha. Okay, so back to your current story. So you apply, you got this job, staff accountant. They're helping put students in place. Sounds like a fairly small firm.
Yeah, very small, and I don't know if you know this, but the economy of Northampton, Massachusetts is a different scale than, say, Boston. I wasn't making a lot of money, but also my rent wasn't a lot of money. It was just, we were kind of in stasis and trying to figure out, what's our next step? Do we want to stick around here? Do we want to go somewhere else? You know, my girlfriend at the time, she and I kind of sat down. We're both from the West Coast originally, and we both kind of said, you know, this isn't sustainable. We don't. Like, I'm never going to make more than I'm making now. At the time, I think I was making like $13 an hour or something. And she was making minimum wage at a bookstore in town.
And that's like what you were making at that part-time job when you were a student in Berkeley.
Right, exactly. I was making less than I was making at Berkeley. But also I was paying, you know, $275 a month in rent or something ridiculous. But at the same time, you know, you can't. It's an economy of scale. If my pay had been higher and my rent had been higher, I could still theoretically save more over time. So sure. I kind of went, okay, we need to figure out something to do. And we both made the decision to come back to the West Coast to kind of give it a shot here, because the tech boom was happening in California. And I'm from the Bay Area originally, so I kind of knew where to go and where not to go, and or maybe more like where to go and where I wouldn't want to live, probably is more accurate. But we, you know, we loaded up, we got a rental car, and we loaded all our stuff up, and we came back to California, and we both just started applying everywhere.
So you returned to California, it's what, 2014?
Yeah, late 2013 at this point.
2013, cool.
Yeah. And then I just started applying everywhere, and, you know, I got a couple contracting gigs doing bookkeeping, and Janine, my girlfriend, I should probably tell you what her name is. She got a job right away, and, you know, we were both living in Oakland. Actually, we are still living in the same apartment in Oakland since 2015, which is a beautiful thing. And, you know, I got into a startup through a temp agency. Actually, I'd been working for a different temp agency doing nonprofit accounting, and the nonprofit where I worked was just completely insane. It was run by lunatics, and it was just, everything was seat of the pants, and everything was, you know, an emergency all the time. You know, every business has its own little dynamic, and that place was just frantic 24 hours a day. And so I said, this isn't going to work. And somehow I found a place less frantic that was still frantic in a startup, which unfortunately has now gone out of business, but was called Dot and Bow, that did, home goods and furniture sales online. So you could buy a couch and have it delivered to your door was sort of the concept. And I worked there in accounts payable and kept kind of getting bumped up. And, you know, it was the same story. You know, you don't know how to do a thing, you figure out how to do the thing. And I ended up leaving and taking another contract job in accounting at a different, more established tech company. And I actually got recruited out of that contract job. The recruiter here at Latote saw me on LinkedIn and saw that he Googled me and saw that I had Facebook friends in common with people who worked at Latote, and contacted me and said, hey, you have great startup experience. You have great accounting experience. It looks like you've grown in every company you worked for. Why don't you come over and interview? We're looking for an accountant. And I said, sure, absolutely. And came over and, that's how I got hired on at Latote. I met the original CFO, and she was great. And the company was very scrappy, and you know, they were in kind of an ugly space in what used to be a warehouse, but they were doing interesting work, and everybody seemed really nice. And kind of the rest, as they say, is history. I ended up here in March of 2016, and I've been here ever since.
Well, that's great. I am surprised and yet heartened to hear that, like, you managed to get to where you are without going through a big accounting program or anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that did happen, and I just completely spaced on this and skipped right over it, I did do a master's program in accounting.
Oh.
But it was not a big accounting program. It's not a name school. You probably haven't heard of it. It's called New England College. Not New England College of Business, which you may have seen ads for, but New England College, which is in some tiny town up in New Hampshire. Okay. And they have an online master's degree in accounting that requires no undergraduate coursework in accounting as long as you can pass a couple of placement tests. And so it's geared for people who work in accounting basically and have no accounting degree, which is me to a T. And
so, when did you start that program? Or let's say if you go, like, when did you say, hey, I probably should get a degree?
And then, this was when I was at the really frantic nonprofit. My title officially was junior accountant, and I felt like I kept getting kind of pigeonholed into these like cleanup, like data entry kind of roles. And I wanted to move to the next level. And you can absolutely do that by just incrementally getting promoted or getting a new job and moving up without having a degree. And I know this because I have plenty of friends who have done that. But I also have found that the quickest way to up your salary or get you the title bump you're looking for is to just go get a degree or get some kind of certification or something. And so I kind of looked at cost analysis and, you know, how much money would I have to put out and how much money would I get back? And in all honesty, I mean, the program took me a year and a half. It was an 18-ish month program. And I almost, within 2 months of finishing that program, I had a new job that paid $20,000 a year more than I had previously.
Wow. Is there a dog in the background or something?
Yes, there is. I'm very sorry. We have a so one of the things about being in a startup, which is hilarious to me, is that all the offices are open offices. There's no cubicles. There's no office, like literal office spaces where the president or vice president sit or whatever. And our particular office happens to be a dog-friendly office. So there are about 5 to 10 dogs in the office at any given time.
Well,
and so that dog you're hearing in the background is a little pug by the name of Garbanzo, who will never shut up ever. He's the loudest dog I've ever seen. I love him, but man, is he noisy.
Oh, my God. Well, you have my sympathy then. So when you say it took about 18 months, was this like – I mean, were this like 18 months you not just doing this, or was this like, you know, part-time while you were still working full-time? Or
this was part-time while I was still working full-time. Cool. And this actually, this program, the cool thing about it was that it was asynchronous. So you didn't have to sign on at 6 o'clock and listen to a lecture. It was all pre-recorded stuff, written materials, textbooks. And it was very much the way I sort of learned accounting in the first place, which is read the thing and do the thing and prove you can do it.
And when you say it's asynchronous, because Berkeley, of course, has a pretty big online school. I actually have a course that I wrote for Berkeley Online.
Sure.
And let's say there's no specific time everyone has to be on, but Berkeley does have like a 12-week term, and
right,
every week there's your homework due by Monday night. Whereas, right, I have a friend who did a vet tech program where literally, here's the content, do it whenever you want. If it takes you 3 days or 3 years, we don't care. Send in the exam when you're done.
Yeah, this was more of the former. Each class was 7 weeks. You took one class at a time. And there were deadlines within that 7 week schedule. Like you might have a project due week 4, or, you know, the final has to be done by week 7 on Saturday or whatever. So it was asynchronous in the sense that as long as you hit all the deadlines and milestones, you could log in on your lunch break. You could log in at 1 o'clock in the morning. It didn't really matter.
Sure.
But there were still, you know, you still had to complete the coursework by the deadline. But usually the deadline for if there was a homework assignment was like Sunday at 3:30 in the morning Pacific time. So if you're on the East Coast, it's 6:30 in the morning. And that worked out pretty well for me because it meant that I could, you know, do a little reading on my lunch break, or I could turn in an assignment that I had written the night before and do a quick look over and send it off. And it was actually super flexible in that regard. And if you couldn't make a deadline and you knew in advance, you could kind of work with the professor to make it work. And everybody in that program, with a couple of exceptions, were all working professionals trying to get a master's degree. So it was a very good program for the money, especially.
I was to ask, because you mentioned a $20,000 raise.
Yes.
How much total tuition did you pay in this program?
$24,000.
Oh, so that's a rate of return of about 83%.
Yes. Yes, it is. And it's not a one-time thing. I'm still making more money. That I've gotten raises multiple times since I got hired on. And so, you know, part of that has been, you know, the degree legitimized my knowledge to an extent, because it meant, hey, look, he actually knows something. Here's a piece of paper with his name on it. And then once I had that, it was just a matter of continuing to do things well. And now nobody cares that I have a master's degree in accounting. They care that I know how to do accounting. And so because I've been with the same company since I finished the program, you know, it's never like, well, you have your master's degree, so we'll give you an extra $500. It was always, yeah, you're doing a great job. You're taking on all these projects. Here you go. So it was kind of like a nice move to a new baseline, and now I'm trusted with higher level work.
Sure. And by the way, so it sounds like you are not a CPA, or did you take that exam?
I am not a CPA. I still have the option to take it, and actually it varies by state, but in the state of California, if you have a master's degree in accounting, it wipes a lot of the accounting coursework requirements. It basically, they assume that if you have a master's and you have a certain number of credits in accounting, that it's good enough for those requirements. You still have to have a few supplemental classes that you have to fulfill, but I'm something like 9 college credits away from qualifying to be a CPA if I pass the exams. And I mean, I could take any business class for those 9 credits.
Gotcha.
So it's one of those things where if I did that, again, it could boost me into the next level of salary, and that option doesn't go away. I still have those credits. That's still all valid. I would just have to prepare for the exam.
Gotcha. Hey, it's cool, man. I was going to say, you're talking to a full-time college faculty member who doesn't have a PhD, so.
Well, there you go, yeah. Whatever works. Whatever works.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Great. So, hey, let's move on to the next part of the interview.
Sure.
Which is my first question for you. Now, and there's no right or wrong answer, is these days, what, if anything, is your current relationship with music?
Complicated is the short answer. This is a tough question. I still listen to it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I have earbuds in the whole day at work, and I'm listening to all kinds of stuff all the time. Because it helps me to focus. Honestly, like sometimes I'm listening to instrumental jazz, and sometimes if I'm in a bad mood, I'm listening to, you know, angry punk rock or whatever. But I still listen a lot. After I left the grad program that I was doing in music, I took kind of a sabbatical from listening even. I kind of didn't listen or think or talk about it at all for about 6 months after I left that program. I really got over it. And when we moved back to California, actually, I have a number of friends that I met at Berkeley who are originally from the Bay Area, and they relocated back to the Bay Area. And so when I came back, I kind of got sucked back into, you know, these are my good friends who I went to college with, and, you know, now we're hanging out, and we always related through music. And it kind of complicated things because I wasn't a working musician the way they were. You know, I have a couple friends, actually several friends, who are music educators out here. And, you know, I'm an accountant, and I think they think of me as like having sold out in some way. I don't know if that's true. It might just be my own personal paranoia, but I definitely, you know, we still talk about music, and, you know, I'm a jazz composition major at heart, and, you know, I make dumb jazz theory jokes to them all the time, and they still think it's funny. But, you know, it's just, it's a different kind of thing. I'm not actively writing in the same way that I used to. I'm not actively playing at all. I sold my trombone when we moved back to the West Coast. We needed the money. And I have a new horn now, but I barely played it. And, you know, it's complicated because I always think, like, I want to get back into music, or, you know, I hear some piece of music that I love, some new thing I've never heard before, and I think, man, I'd love to start writing again. And, you know, every once in a while I'll do something. I'll, you know, noodle on the piano or whatever, or on a keyboard. I don't have a piano. But, it's not as visible in my life as I think I had hoped it would be. And I think I actually am not balanced enough in that way. I think I need to spend more time with music and less time with numbers sometimes.
Okay, very fair. So my next question for you is, in your current role as the staff accountant, mm-hmm. Special Company, obviously, you have a kind of interesting path that got you there. You're, I'm sure, in a very small percentage of accountants who went to someplace like Berkeley.
Probably, yeah.
So let's say, relative to if you'd gone to, let's say, stayed at that community college in California or gone to UMass Amherst for your undergrad or something.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you feel that you're, you know, Berkeley experience did particularly well to prepare you for what you're doing now?
Yeah, actually, I think there's a couple of things.
Sure.
I don't know if this is still the experience. Obviously, I haven't been a student at Berkeley for 10 or so, or roughly 10 years. But there was this famous thing that my fellow students and I used to talk about all the time called the Berkeley Runaround. And it was the process of trying to get anything done by the administration.
And wasn't that like where you're always, each office would tell you to go to this other office?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, financial aid would say the problem's in the registrar's office. You go down to the registrar's office. No, it's with the bursar's office. You go back to the bursar's office. No, you know, it's not us. Financial aid didn't release the money. You have to go back to financial aid. And, you know, I think I've ridden the elevator in the Uchida building about 9 billion times without actually. And so, you know, that kind of experience with like weird, like, I have gone to public institutions. I've gone to a community college, and the runaround was never as bad as it was at Berkeley when we were there. Okay. And so
I'm waiting to hear how this becomes a feature rather than a bug.
Well, at the time it was a bug, and it probably the experience itself is a bug. But the feature is that as I advanced through Berkeley, the longer I stayed, the more I began to expect the Berkeley runaround. And so I would attack on multiple fronts all at once. And so I started to learn that if financial aid says registrar needs this thing, I say, okay, give it to me in writing so that I can take it down to the registrar's office and get exactly what you need. And so I started to kind of learn, okay, they're going to send me probably to this other office, and the other office is going to send me to another office. How do I cut through that and get to the source of the problem without having to go up and down and up and down and up and down in the elevator? And it kind of taught me how to just go look at a problem and say, okay, the problem looks like X, but it's actually all these little problems or just this one minor problem that's blowing up and making it look like this huge thing. And so that actually was a huge thing for me. I've gotten really good at just cutting through red tape and finding what's the actual problem. Don't send me somewhere else. Let's just figure out what's the actual issue. And again, it's a bug, 100%. But that bug is everywhere. It's not just at Berkeley. It's almost every company I've ever worked for somewhere in the process. You know, it's, you know, maybe you get laid off from your job and you have to apply for unemployment. It's there. Maybe you have to go to the bank because the bank made a mistake, or now call the bank. I guess you can probably have a bank account if it's all online, but it's there too. It's everywhere. And I think Berkeley absolutely prepared me for just the obnoxious minutiae of being a person. And they didn't mean to, but it worked out really well because I'm really good at saying, hey, instead of making this horrible process, can't we just do the straightforward approach and fix it? And often I'm praised for that because I can kind of see, hey, this is a horrible thing you're making everyone do. Can't we just do it the really easy way that's really obvious?
I like it.
Yeah.
You said there were a couple things. That's one.
That's one. I would say that Berkeley also, as an institution, and I think maybe this is because of the department I was in, because jazz composition is a very small program, but with a fairly broad set of course offerings that are sort of cross-departmental. And, you know, you can take advanced harmony classes, you can take advanced arranging classes, there's all kinds of different things you can do. I think the fact that I was able to kind of study what I wanted to study without having to take a ton of classes that I absolutely didn't want to have to take was a huge thing for me personally, because it made me want to go to class. I've always been the guy who, you know, I think a good student at the core. I'm good at teaching myself things, but if I'm not interested, I have a really hard time showing up. And I think Berkeley had few enough of those classes that felt like a drag to me personally, that I was able to kind of just show up. And even the things that were a drag weren't really that bad once I showed up. And it was a lot easier to show up to, like, and maybe I probably shouldn't say this, but Tonal Two-Part Canon and Invention was the class that for me was just like, I don't want to take this class. I just didn't want to do it. And it was in the middle of my day between two of my favorite classes. So it was like, I'm not going to skip it. It's in the middle of two things I'm going to anyway. Why would I skip this course? And it turned out it wasn't nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be when I started the semester. So I think just the act of motivating me to show up was a big deal for me. If I had gone to a big university, I probably would have skipped a lot of those kinds of classes, and I have no idea how well I would have done. So the small class sizes also are a part of that, because if you're not there, boy, do they notice that you're not there. Whereas if you're in a lecture hall of 200 students, like, you don't even know if the professor's there half the time. So I think all of those things combined helped a lot.
It got you good habits?
What's that?
Was it like it got you good learning habits? I'm just trying to...
Good learning habits in a sense, and also just got me to be present in a way that I think maybe I... You know, it did feel like if I skip this class, it's not a big deal. You know, and it never felt like that to me. It was like, I need to show up. Mm-hmm. And I know plenty of people who that wasn't true for. They still skipped classes or whatever, but it always felt like if I had to miss class... there had to be a reason. It wasn't just like, I'm going to go sit on the beach or whatever. You know, I actually had to have a reason to not go. And I think that alone, you know, it was sort of like a delayed gratification thing. Like, yeah, I have to go to this class, but maybe I'll actually learn something that I like learning or like doing. There was that feature of me having to give things a shot that I really appreciated. And I, you know, maybe that's a thing that happens at every school, but Berkeley was maybe the first time in my education from maybe middle school forward where it felt like I could just give this a shot. And if it's terrible, it's terrible, but it probably won't be. You know, high school, there's always that class you don't want to take, but you have to go. And I always was super reluctant to show up to classes like that. So, you know, again, probably a good student, but just bad habits, at that point.
Okay, very fair. Well, hey, let's turn that question around now, because Berkeley gives that one degree, a Bachelor of Music, and you went there knowing that.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, you're in a good career now, even if it's not a musical one. But all that said, when you look back at your Berkeley education, is there anything where you say, you know, hey, it would have been really useful to have learned this while I was at Berkeley, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't? Anything missing or incomplete?
Yeah. And I think I don't know how true this is, but I'm going to start with what might be a bald-faced lie. But
let it all out, man.
Yeah. I think Berkeley doesn't do a great job of telling you that you can have a career outside of music and that it's okay. I think that there's sort of a – like, for me, at least, there was a shame component to not being a musician at first. It felt like, okay, I spent however many thousands of dollars and how much time to get my degree, and I spent all this time immersed in music and learning all this theory and learning how to, you know, write for a cappella vocals or for 18-piece big band or whatever. If I don't use that, I've wasted my time. And I don't think it was a waste of time, even though I'm not a working musician. You know, I value that time in my life very heavily. And for a long time, I felt kind of like I had personally failed by not becoming the next, I don't know, I was going to say John Mayer, but that's a bad example. But you get the John Mayer of jazz composition. I don't know.
Sure, sure.
But there is a part of me that kind of went like, I could have gone, but Maria Schneider, that's a good example. Maria Schneider, you know, I could have been more like her, and I could have, you know, started my own big band and written for it and done all this. And it's like, at the end of the day, like, you got to do what's right for you. And I think Berklee does a really great job of like motivating you, like, you're going to be a musician. And then when you come out the other side, if you're not a musician, it feels terrible. And so it took me a while to come to terms with that. And I still have friends from Berklee who say, like, how are you an accountant? How can you do that all day, every day? And it's not so bad. Like, I like it fine, but, you know, it's not maybe what I spent all that time training for. But, you know, I think also the flip side of that is that Berklee didn't really prepare you for the actual act of being either a professional musician or a professional in general. I feel like there were expectations in certain classes that were, you know, we need you to act professionally, and here's how that looks. But, you know, I didn't ever feel like there was like a career replacement path or, like, you know, you never, there, like, every time I would go to the career center, it never felt like I was going to go get, you know, a good amount of time to meet with a career counselor and go over what I wanted to do and how to do it. It was more like, oh, I can print stuff from up there, you know? So that part felt a little weird to me, but I think also that was on me because I didn't seek those kinds of courses out. I didn't study, I didn't take any music business classes or professional music kind of classes or anything when I was at Berklee. I just kind of stuck to my major and whatever the requirements were. And part of that was me trying to be efficient and not spend more money than I needed to on tuition. Berklee's expensive. But I kind of wish there had been more available programs for people to kind of go and say, hey, if I want to do X, how do I do it? You know, where's the professional preparation beyond the skill? And to this day, I still don't fully understand, like, if I wanted to be a professional jazz composer or arranger, how do you do it? Like, there's not really a good answer to that question, and I've been asking it for a long time. So, you know, I think it would have been really helpful to know that and maybe hold the departments accountable a little bit, especially in the more traditional musical fields, you know, songwriting, jazz composition, tech performance, whatever. It would be nice if maybe they could kind of talk to their students and say, hey, this, you know, here are some ways you can apply your degree when you're done.
Sure. I know that the Berklee Career Center just this past year got a new director that's been doing a real top to bottom makeover.
Oh, great. That's good to hear. I mean, I have no idea if it's any good or not. I assume it's better, but
yeah.
But it's tough to, you know, at the time it was really tough.
No, I get it. And obviously, whenever I'm asking people about stuff, you're essentially telling me about Berklee as of a decade ago.
Right. But absolutely. There's definitely a delay here. You guys didn't have the big tower when I went there. I don't even know, you know, this. You know, I used to take classes under the McDonald's. It was on Massachusetts Avenue, you know. So
that got ripped down to build the tower.
Yes, thankfully, because, man, I had a class. I don't even know why I'm going off on this tangent, but I had a class under the McDonald's. There was a basement classroom in that building behind the McDonald's. It was actually under the kitchen.
Oh,
and man. And the ceiling leaked. And I assume it was water. We kind of learned where the splash zone was. I mean, nobody ever sat in those desks, but, the class that I took was Music Preparation 1, which I don't even know if you guys offer that class anymore, but it was literally handwriting sheet music with a calligraphy pen.
Wow.
And if you sat in the splash zone and water, calligraphy ink is not waterproof and it can ruin your whole thing.
Oh my God.
It was like the worst possible class for that to happen.
I'm laughing.
God, it was
I shouldn't laugh. Yeah. Well, the classroom's definitely gone now. I can tell you that there's actually, like, probably in the exact, you know, cubic foot of area where this horrible leak was, is probably some, is where the state-of-the-art recording studios now are. So,
hey, works for me. I mean, it was one of those things, I think they only used that class sparingly. Like, they absolutely needed the room, they used it, and it. And this was one of those classes that, like, was on the way out when I took it. It was no longer a requirement this semester after I declared the major. And so I'm pretty sure they were just like, let's stick them in the basement. No one will notice. And, you know, there were like eight of us in the class and we were all kind of like, why are we down here? Why does it smell like fries? So, but you know, I never had another class down there and I never knew anyone else who had a class down there.
Yeah,
so
I'm blissfully unaware of that classroom.
Yes.
Okay. So, all right, well, hey, my next question for you is, the funny thing was that, you know, again, you sort of started, got your feet wet in accounting while you were still in college, mm-hmm. and then had those couple years right before you got back into it, and then you were on a pretty clear path with that detour into grad school.
Right.
The first grad school.
Right.
So, let's say, you know, so a couple bumps and delays, but you got on that path, you stuck on, and you're doing really well for yourself. Not everybody has found that path. You know, there are recent grads who are still perhaps looking or, you know, still working as a barista, right? And going like, you know, what else is there? And also people maybe even their last year who might be dimly aware that there's a big world out there and, you know, oh, my God, what am I going to do?
Sure.
Right. So, like, for either of both of those groups, do you have any advice?
Yes. I will start with don't listen to people when they tell you to do what you love, because it's maybe the worst advice I've ever gotten. Sorry, I almost swore.
So it sounds like it's like shit.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's on the one – and again, there's – I get where it's coming from. I think the full expression is do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. That's the expression that I grew up hearing all the time. And just, it's shit. It on the one hand, it devalues work because the implication is that if you're doing something you like, it's not really work. And that's not true. Anyone who's ever taken a music class and enjoyed it knows it's still work. You still have to practice your scales to get better at your instrument. It's still work. It's still hard.
I have a confession to make, which is I said, if I can make a confession here.
Sure.
Which is I overall definitely love being a professor. But I will admit that when it's the day after final exams and I'm staring at that big stack of papers to grade, I'm not like, wee!
Yep. There is good and bad in everything. In everything. And so that the first problem I have is it devalues work, and it especially devalues work in the arts, in music, in visual art, in writing. I mean, I cannot tell you how many horror stories I've heard from my friends, because a lot of them are professional musicians, artists, writers, whatever, who have said things like, you know, I got offered this gig at this restaurant and it's $20 plus exposure for a 3-hour gig. And it's like, no, in no other field, like no one would ever offer me a job and say, we're going to pay you $9 an hour to be a staff accountant, but you're going to get great experience on your resume. Like, on the one hand, if you're an intern, that's a whole – I don't even want to get into interning because I will go on a rant. But if you're an intern, you're getting paid in experience, right, for the most part. The point is to have something on your resume so that when you apply, you have something there. But if I have 3 years of experience, they're not going to pay me in experience. You know what I mean? Like the experience comes with the working for the company and you should expect a salary. And I know lots of people who work in music and in writing, especially like create – you know, like copywriting and things like that, freelance writing, that get devalued because they wanted to be writers and they went into a creative field and the economy or, you know, the general marketplace doesn't value those skills the same way they would an engineer, an accountant, you know, somebody like that. It's mm-hmm. a different kind of skill, but it's really and part of that is, well, you get to be a writer all day. Like, why would I pay you as much? You love what you do. It's not as hard. Makes me crazy. So throw that out the window. Just throw it out the window. Maybe you're going to music school and you want to be a professional musician, but you don't know how to do it. Thinking about it in terms of like, well, I love playing the guitar, so all I want to do is play the guitar. It's not going to work, you know. I would say if you're thinking about music specifically, think about what you're good at in music, and maybe it's playing the guitar, or maybe it's explaining how to play the guitar or showing people how to play the guitar, or maybe it's, hey, you know, I'm a pretty good writer, but I'm not great with like physically writing music down. Maybe I would be good at doing some kind, you know, like rock music co-writing, where you're doing more of like a, hey, yeah, you've got the basic song, now let's work on the larger arrangement. Maybe you would be good at that because you don't have to physically write the music down. You don't have to deal with the notation. Maybe you are a better singer than you think you are, you know, and you can kind of apply that out into the larger world. You know, what other jobs interest you? What else in the world interests you? Because no one only likes music. That's nuts. I have interests. I mean, I've always been good with numbers, so I kind of fell into this, but like, I'm also interested in urban planning, for example. I could see myself working in urban planning very easily, you know, the way cities are constructed and how streets are built and the grid system and the history of the interstate system. I'm interested in all this stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't just pigeonhole yourself in because you have a degree in a thing. And I think it's really important to kind of think about, yeah, okay, what else do I like? And also, what else would I be willing to do? Because, you know, yeah, you could be a barista and you could go, oh, this is terrible. Maybe you think it's terrible. Maybe you love being a barista. But if you're trying to change career paths, you shouldn't just think about what you love or what you like. Think about what you're willing to do, because maybe you'll fall in love with it. You know, it's not everything is vanilla ice cream where you like it right away. Some things are a little harder to like, things like, I don't know, bourbon, for example. I hated it the first time I had it, and now it's my favorite alcohol, you know? Like, you kind of have to just give stuff a shot and try it on and think about, you know, what have I done and liked, and what is kind of similar to that, you know? And then if you don't have the experience, try to find a way to get a little bit of experience. And maybe it means you go volunteer for an organization that needs somebody who wants to try that thing, you know? You never know. Use the people you know who are musicians or non-musicians, because we have a network of both, and try to see what other people are doing and like, and think about whether or not you'd like to do that. Keep an open mind and know that the right opportunity might be just around the corner, or it might be nine corners away, but the only way you're going to figure that out is by trying stuff on and seeing if it's okay.
Gotcha. A great answer. So, hey, let's zoom in a little now.
Sure.
Because you're, I believe, the second accountant I've talked to and something like the 118th person.
Okay.
Maybe 116th. Okay. Sure. So, point is, I don't think anyone's listening to all 116-plus interviews. But, right, so who's listening to this conversation now? The people who are like, oh, staff accountant. Oh, you know, what's that all about?
Sure.
Oh, you know, you get to be the guru, you get to work with numbers, everyone, you know, you're doing some cool stuff, it's, you know, solving problems. Okay, this sounds pretty cool. Like, hey, like, how can I get in on this? Like, for somebody who is an aspiring staff accountant, do you have any specific advice for them?
Yes, I do. Don't be deterred, first of all, by the fact that you haven't done accounting before, because you have done accounting before. It just doesn't seem like you have. Anytime you look at your bank account and think, how much money can I spend before I run out of money and still pay the rent? You're doing more or less what I do, just on a very different scale. So don't be concerned that you can't do it, because a lot of people can do it. You may struggle with paying the rent. That's an entirely separate issue. But if you're able to kind of think about your money conceptually instead of literally, I think you're already 10 steps ahead. And there are a lot of places that will hire you with, you know, maybe they need somebody to pay bills, or maybe they need somebody to send bills. You know, everybody needs that kind of work done. You know, if you're a business, people need to pay you and you need to pay people. So find an entry-level job in those fields. They exist. Especially smaller companies tend to not want to pay as much, so they'll tend to hire people who maybe are less qualified and just want to get their feet wet and figure out what they're doing. There's also, I mean, I know Berkeley, when I was there, offered, you know, accounting 101 type classes. I don't know the actual number, but it was financial accounting, which is useful, but also maybe too much if you have no background or proclivity for accounting. I have found that it just getting, like, logging into an accounting system, like maybe QuickBooks, I think QuickBooks Online gives you like a free test account or whatever. If you're not actually doing books for somebody, I think you can actually get like a free subscription. And if you can't, there's a program called Wave. I think it's waveapps.com. That's a free QuickBooks like system. You can go in there and poke around and see how stuff works and see, you know, does this make any kind of sense? And then try Googling it and saying, what does this mean? What is, how does that work? You know, because I think poking around is one of the ways to get interested in something. You know, hey, that looks kind of interesting. How does that work? What does that do? And, you know, just try talking to an accountant sometime. I mean, we're not scary, I promise. And most of us are actually quite nice. And we're willing to talk to you. And also, you know, as you talk to people, especially people who work in accounting, like, they remember people who are interested in trying something new and maybe don't have any experience. I have recommended friends for jobs in accounting because they've been interested in accounting and they've seemed interested in learning and, you know, they can remember things. You know, I have a friend of mine who's a lot younger than me, he's like in his early 20s, and he's attending a different music school out here on the West Coast. And he's thinking about going into accounting when he finishes school as a day job, because he's seen that I can do it with a music degree. And he kind of went, oh, maybe I can do it too. And so every once in a while, we'll talk about it. And he'll, you know, he'll ask me, like, well, what's the difference between doing accounts payable and accounts receivable or whatever? And, you know, find whether or not you're, if you've decided you're interested in it, do some reading, do a little messing around in some kind of free accounting system and see if it's something you'd actually want to work in. Cause I definitely know people who are accountants, but aren't, you know, they maybe enjoy the numbers part of it, but they don't enjoy working in systems like that. And you kind of need to know how to do that and be able to put up with every system's little quirks. Maybe my biggest piece of advice, though, would be undaunted when let's say you go into a temp agency or whatever, and you say, I really want to work in accounting, but I don't have experience. And they may push back because you don't have experience. Push right back again, because, you know, a temp agency makes their money by hiring you to go do work for somebody else. They don't get paid unless you get paid. And if you really go in there and say, I want to gain experience and try this out, it's a great way to get your foot in the door, make a little bit of money, and say, is this something I want to do? Temp agencies are great for trying stuff like this on, especially in fields where you don't have a lot of experience. And that goes beyond accounting, too. If you're interested in marketing, or you're interested in, maybe I want to be an office manager, go talk to a temp agency that works in those fields and see if they'll get you placed somewhere.
Gotcha. Great answer. Well, hey, Jared, I only have one last question for you, which is, you have the mic. And you're being recorded. Is there anything we missed? Anything else you'd like to say?
I don't think so. I will say that being an accountant is a lot cooler than I thought it was going to be. When I was a music student, I was very much, I had this very specific idea kind of what I was going to be, and I'm not what I thought I was going to be, and that's kind of how life goes. So, you know, if you're listening to this, it means that you probably are trying to think about what you're going to do with the $100,000 plus piece of paper you have. So, you know, good on you for thinking about it. I think that puts you way ahead of everybody else. I wasn't thinking about that in the same way when I was in my last few semesters at Berkeley. I was definitely thinking, this is how it's going to happen. And it didn't happen that way. Keep an open mind is just my calling card piece of advice that I give to everyone about almost everything. So do that, and you should be fine.
All right, great. Well, hey, Jared, I really enjoyed this conversation.
So, thank you. I did too.
All right, great. So, hey, look for a message from me in the very near future, and best of luck with everything.
Thanks. I really appreciate it.
All right, have a great evening.
Thanks. You too.
Bye.
Bye.